My name is John Lundblad. I'm on the teaching staff up here at Holden. Been here for the last 2.5 weeks. Currently, my family and I live in Jerusalem, where I work for the Lutheran Church in America as a staff pastor at Church of the Redeemer, a German Protestant church in the middle of the Old City, which also offers a English language ministry. So I'm known as the English-speaking pastor at Church of the Redeemer. The British, of course, who come by say that that's a slight on the language, that I am the American-speaking language at Church of the Redeemer. I've been there for the last 5.5 years, going back now a week from today. We're flying somewhere between Copenhagen and Tel Aviv about this time, and to start another 2-year term there. Part of my work in Jerusalem is with an expatriate congregation, a regular parish ministry of worship and study programs. Part of my ministry is with tourists and pilgrims and students and wanderers and wanderers and others who have always come to Jerusalem. Part of my work is also in terms of interfaith and ecumenical concerns, and it's to that subject that we want to turn today, particularly that the interfaith aspect, the Christians and Jews. Titled this discussion today, Christians and Jews in a Post-Holocaust World. We'll talk some more about the title a little later. As I thought about it after I told Charlie that I wanted to do it, I figured that I should get some ideas to what I had in mind, which I really didn't when I gave the program director the title. I thought it could be approached biblically, but I'd already been doing that in the discussions we had earlier on Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11. I thought about it doing it from a historical or theological standpoint, but that would mean that I would talk far too much, which is my tendency. And also in talking with another person on the staff around here, raised some new issues in my mind. So I'd like to begin with a couple of questions leading into a discussion that is not so much a biblical understanding, a theological understanding, but how do we as Christians relate to Jews in this current world, which is a post-Holocaust world. We'll come back to that term a little bit. First of all, how many of you live in either New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles? 5 people. Okay. The vast majority of you then do not live with high concentrations of Jewish populations in your communities. There are 6 million Jews in the United States. Half of the Jews in the world live in the United States. There are 3.2 million in Israel, 3 million scattered everywhere from Iran to Egypt to South America to Asia to Africa to China to India to everywhere else. 6 million, half the world's population of Jews live in the United States. Of that 6 million, 3 million of them live in New York, greater New York area. The other 3 million are scattered primarily in Chicago, Los Angeles, I should have added Florida. Florida. Okay, okay. Once you eliminate those areas, New York, the cities of the major cities of Florida, Chicago and Los Angeles, that's well over 5 million of the 6 million Jews in the United States. The other million are scattered in small towns and the other cities of the United States, which means that by and large, unless you live in one of those urban concentrations, you have not lived in areas with high Jewish populations. And that's our starting point, that I think the majority of us do not have extensive and intensive experience with Jewish neighbors, with Jewish communities, with Jews who happen to live down the street. I might be wrong in that, and if I am, then we're going to change our discussion this morning. What I'd like to begin with is just a straight question. How many of you know Jews, and in what context, and to what extent? Just an example. You don't have to give great definitions of who they are, but a number of you just say what Jews you now know, and in what, to what extent, and in what context. Yeah.
Neighbors in business and
Give a specific example, someone, you know, a person.
Our next door neighbors. Mm-hmm. They're a Jewish couple, and we have a very good friendship with them.
Religious or secular?
Mostly secular, but they've had friends over who are still Jews, and they have talked to us, and, you know, hope that, you know, we'll encourage them to, you know, and expose them to the gospel, which is something that has to be done really very casually. But mostly my experience, I knew a lot. I lived in a community where I went to a high school that was 60% Jewish. And I knew and fellowshipped or interacted more with them, with Jews in high school, you know, on that level. But once we graduated, they kind of went into their lifestyle with,
okay.
And then I went.
Okay. Someone else. Yeah.
I had a lot of experience with Jewish people. When I was at the University of Washington, I had several Jewish ladies read to me. And I know a number of Jews through the Masonic Lodge and through the Lions Club. And I operate a small school of piano fitting in Vancouver, Washington. I've had two students directly from Israel.
Okay. So is that someone else? Charlie.
I have a brother-in-law who is a Jew, so we know him through the family, and we've got to know his family, and of course I'm a civil rabbi.
What kind, Reformed, conservative, or Orthodox?
Both Reformed and conservative, no okay. Orthodox.
Okay. And?
Two examples of... One of my best girlfriends is from her early 20s, from an affluent Boston family, and a young businesswoman in her own right, and a very close set of surrogate parents who are Israeli Jews living in Israel. She came from Germany just before the war, and he from Canada. They're in their 60s.
Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
I've had several experiences. I have good friends, I have neighbors, I've taught Jewish students. My husband and I worked at a girls' camp in Maine many years ago, which was, it was supposed to be a mixed group, but because there was difficulty in getting Jewish girls into camps, it was about 99% Jewish girls. And they wanted us there because we were non-Jewish. They were interested in being non-Jewish. So we worked with those girls for 2 summers. There was no religious interchange there. These were girls from 6 to 16. No religious, but they were from very affluent families from Boston and Philadelphia, New York.
Yeah.
The hospice program that I was formerly with had two Jewish team members.
Okay. How many of you who, you know, among this, would have close contact with religious Jews? That is, people who observe kosher, observe the Shabbat, the Sabbath, and regularly attend synagogue or temple worship? Two? Three? Plus those who have come to know rabbis. Of that, how many have ever had contact with Orthodox Judaism? Yeah, you would. Okay. How many of you who know Jews would characterize them roughly? Now, this generalization would characterize them primarily as secular rather than religious. If you have Jewish friends, neighbors, and the like, would they be secular or religious?
Secular.
Secular. Okay. One other question just before we get in. In terms of public people, what Jews do you think of? Anybody at all that you can think of who is somehow entertainment, sports, politics, government, finance, anything at all, what Jews can you think of, and give me an attribute that you would connect to that person, and anybody who says Sammy Davis Jr. and black is thrown out.
Okay.
Goldemeyer, and what attribute?
Courage.
No. Someone else.
Sacrifice.
Mel Brooks. And
humor.
Someone
Shall
else.
Sandy
Koufax.
I'm sorry, I got two here going.
Shelley Winters, aggressive.
Aggressive.
Sandy Koufax, sports.
Okay.
Menachem Begin, political.
That's a good neutral term. Anybody else?
Barbara Streisand.
Okay.
What is that gentleman's name that plays the violins?
Let's put some of these attributes down that we think of that came up. Okay. If you were to, in the back of your mind, and okay, someone in here is probably saying this has a tendency to be anti-Semitic. We're going to come back to this whole discussion in a bit. But if you were to ask yourself, very general, non-judgmental, what attributes do you kind of think of if someone says Jewish attributes? What comes to your mind? Someone said educated. What else?
Pushy.
Someone said pushy, someone
said.
What else?
I say they're very public spirited. Jewish people that I've known.
Public? What else?
Businessman.
Businessman.
What else?
Artistic.
Okay. What else?
Goal oriented.
Goals? What else?
Anxiety ridden.
What else?
Extrovert.
What else? What else?
Wealthy.
Someone is finally getting really honest. At least about how we feel. What else?
Clownish.
Okay, let's stick that
on.
What else?
People that I know are very friendly.
I would say that, you know, given the experience and the thing, these would be, if you ask the majority of Americans or Westerners, Christian or non-Christian, religious or secular, these attributes would generally be felt by people. We're not going to make a judgment on them at this point. But kind of keep these in mind, especially the idea of community or clannishness, the education, pushy, extrovert, may even go together, and especially maybe just set right here. Business, artistic goals, anxiety, and wealthy. Okay, just keep them in mind because we're going to go back exactly to that question that Daniel just raised. Since most of us as Lutherans, those of us who are Lutherans, would generally be Scandinavian or Germanic backgrounds, what attributes would we, in that same general non-judgmental way, give to us?
Stubborn.
it's easier to be honest about ourselves. What?
Determined.
Okay. Authoritarian. Ambitious. Someone said
planning.
Regressed.
Wonderful.
Cold. Narrow-minded.
That's right.
That's for Daniel. What else?
Judgmental.
Prejudice. We really want to say that.
What was it?
Okay.
WASP. White Anglo.
How about the question of wealth poverty?
We're very poor.
Middle
but they became prostitutes. My own dad landed here when he was 17 years old and only had $17.
Okay. You come in class, how do we show our wealth?
Cars.
Are we really, is Scandinavian and German are primarily ostentatious?
No.
Give more to
okay. To get an idea of it, you know, and you can build up these characteristics. But let's make some contrasts, remembering the other. Ambitious. Is that also a, would we say similar to what we consider the Jewish characteristic?
Yes.
Okay. Clannish?
Yes.
Okay. Followers?
No.
Oh.
Another color here. Repressed?
No.
Yes.
Repressed?
Just the bowl. Cold?
No.
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 Not as loud as Jews, that's in the category. Stubborn?
Yes, I can.
Although we've used a different word. We talked about being pushy. We're talking about ourselves as stubborn. Remember that old, the old way we could make the, I am determined you are stubborn, he is a hard-headed fool. Hardworking?
Yes.
Yeah. Work ethic?
Yes.
Okay. Conservative?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Narrow?
No, some are.
Okay.
Then you're not.
Okay, just a book. Judgmental?
Yes.
Middle class?
Yes, most of them.
Just a book. Which means that if you begin to look at it, a lot of the things we said about ourselves might be the same kinds of things that we would say about Jews. But we would also agree that there's something different. That Scandinavians are not Jews. That Germans, at least that there's a different sense
about it. Now, those attributes as we apply them, are they just? Are they bigoted? Are they caricatures? How do we deal with these kind of attributes if we begin to say that all Jews are well off? What if it's a generally accurate statement? I'm not going to argue that it is. When does a generally accurate statement become a bigoted statement?
When you apply it to the individual without
killing
the individual.
Okay.
And you use it against somebody?
Stereotype.
Stereotype? And you use it against someone? Absolutes?
When you let it color your judgment.
Would we generally say... Oh, okay. When we use it to color our judgment, or when we use it out of our own lack of information. And I think that's one of the problems that a lot of us do deal with, is that if we begin to talk about all Lutherans or all Scandinavians, we recognize immediately that where some things might be able to be true, we recognize that there's an element of doubt, simply because we recognize the range of opinion, the range of thought, the range of background, the range of different concerns that everybody has. But somehow it seems easier to say things like all Jews are. And maybe it's because a lot of us don't have that kind of extensive or intensive experience. And yet, in terms of our modern world, the questions that Jews as either Israelis or Jews or as a force in the modern world are presented to us daily. Sweden simply doesn't pose many questions for us. I mean, so we don't have... When was the last time you saw Sweden on the front page of the newspaper? Seriously. Or Norway. Or Finland. Or Denmark. Yeah, the last one was the submarines. You know, and that. You know, we just don't read about it, so we... And also, by and large, how many of you would define yourselves as Swedish?
or Norwegian? Now. Do we really say that, though, about ourselves? What would we normally say? I'm an American of Swedish descent, yeah. Even the idea of, you know, Swedish American, we have some Swedish American societies, or the Sons of Norway, and things like that, but we really don't continue to talk about ourselves that way. And yet we know that somehow Jews still define themselves as Jews. We're not sure how to deal with that either. How can an American also be, you know, how can they maintain that double definition? Because most of us don't work in that same sense. Even if we talk about ourselves as, you know, Christians, we don't make a direct connection between our Christianity and our nationality. You know. And so we can say, I'm an American, I'm a Christian. I could say in an international setting, I'm a North American Christian, I'm a United States Christian. But somehow that doesn't sound the same as to say I'm an American Jew. You know, a person as distinct from a German Jew. We kind of say a Jew is a Jew. A German is a German. The question we have to deal with is that we have these images, we have these reactions, we have these concerns in our mind. We're not sure what to do with them. We don't want to say all Jews are wealthy, and yet, has anybody ever met a poor Jew?
Yeah.
Okay. A few people have. But by and large, it's not the impression that immediately comes to our mind. Unless we've had intensive experiences. You know, it's... So we deal with these on the sense of what can easily become caricatures, or bigoted responses, or questionable responses, or at least uninformed responses simply by lack of information. And they do affect us on our functioning levels. If just because of the 20th century, and I'd like to take a little bit and talk about some history, and then come back to a general discussion about how do we, as North Americans who are Christians, relate to the Jews of the world today, politically, theologically, and personally. But I think we have to deal with three historical aspects in our background. One is that we are, as Christians, and those of you who are in the Bible study, will forgive me for going over this again, we're still dealing on a theological level with the question of the Jewish no to Jesus. That is the fact that Jesus came as the fulfillment of what we assume to be the law and the prophets, and the vast majority of Jews at the time and in history have said no. That either he is not the Messiah, or he is not necessary unto a Jew for salvation. That has led in our history to forced conversions, to pogroms, to inquisitions, to driving people away from Spain, out of Europe. As the Crusaders went off to recapture the Holy Land, they practiced their tactics by attacking Jewish communities along the way. Based on that thing of somehow these people ought to accept Jesus, and they keep saying no. Hence the stubbornness. We're still dealing with that. How do we as Christians deal with the Jewish no to the one we call the Jewish Messiah? A second aspect is what we call the Jewish uniqueness, or in a more negative sense was sometimes called Europe's peculiar people. That is, the Jews stood out. Of course, they stood out because from the medieval period, they always had to wear ridiculous costumes that were required by the civil authorities of the day. But they did. We know that by the sense of community, or what someone said was clannishness, there was the gathering into ghettos, into areas. There was the forced gathering into ghettos, the forced restriction to areas. Now, we had other groups like that in our North American heritage as well. Ones that we might equally call, in that negative term, peculiar people. Anybody want to give an example? Mennonites? What else? Quakers? Anybody else? Shakers?
Amish.
The Amish? in a sense, early ones. But on the in the North American experience, what was possible for those people that was different from Europe?
What? You could move on.
You could move on. So where did the Amish go?
Iowa.
Went to Iowa. Well, when did Iowa? The, and or they could take areas where they simply were out of an urban concentration. Quick response, the majority of German Jews, urban or Europe's Jews, urban or rural?
Urban.
Urban. Because that was the sense. They tended to be an urban people with urban skills, partly by their heritage. This was not always true. The vast majority of Russian Jews were rural. So that's one of our caricatures. But by and large, the European tradition was an urban one. The North American tradition for unique peoples, ones who maintained a particular dress, a particular form of society, and a very particular outlook on the world, were able to go off and develop not so much ghettos in an urban area, but towns and communities where, in effect, they could be left alone and they could leave the world behind. The most striking example of that in American history would be, of course, one group that we didn't name, the Mormons, who faced the same sense of wanting to develop their own unique traditions, faced persecution because of it, and simply could leave and find a whole state. I mean, a whole area that nobody else really wanted, and develop their unique situation.
But you include the Seventh-day Adventists along there, too?
Partly them, too. Where people would want to go off in a particular area and develop their own unique status. That's been part of our North American experience, and that's one of the places where the European experience is very different. So, first, as from the Europe, there was the European heritage of a negative reaction by Christians toward Jews. There was the North American experience of not having to deal with that question. Or if we did, it was very simply done because you could always eliminate people by driving them onwards. They could find somewhere else, or the smarter groups just got out early. That was never a possibility for Europe's Jews. To an extent, it was possible for Russian Jews who could simply leave one town and go off somewhere else. But again, that's where the Russian experience is similar to the North American experience by virtue of the sheer immensity of the land available. Then we come to the 20th century as a radical turning point in Jewish-Christian relationships. And I think this is where we can speak of our century being probably as radical a turning point as, say, the 11th and 12th century and the crusading period and that reaction to the Jewish inhabitants. First, beginning in 1890, the development of modern Zionism, which led to the establishment of the modern state of Israel, which, especially since 1967, has been almost daily front page news. I think if you look at the extent that in the last 15 years, that the Middle East, and particularly the Palestinian-Israeli question, has dominated our thinking as an aspect of foreign policy, it's just amazing. Especially when you think of Israel as a state that is no larger than New Jersey, and has the total population, Arab and Jewish alike, in mandatory Palestine of less than 5 million people. How many people live in Chicago?
8 million.
How many in New York?
9 million.
9 million. Half the population of some of our major cities, you know. Or you can compare it to Cairo. Cairo has somewhere between 6 and 12 million people. Nobody really wants to count. You know, half that population scattered around all of Israel. And yet, for how many different reasons, it's become a primary source of news for us and a primary concern of American foreign policy for at least the last 15 years. So there's been that concern that we've had to deal with, and particularly for all of us, the last 10 years, beginning with the oil embargo of 1973, when the Arab-Israeli conflict really began to hit us on a very personal level. That is, rising gas prices, a concern about foreign aid, military aid, and a concern beginning with some years ago of American military involvement, leading to where we now have the 82nd Airborne Station in Sinai, and later this week 800
Marines will be once again landing on the beaches of Lebanon. So suddenly it's become, you know, for us, a major military involvement. Yeah. That's one aspect of the 20th century. A second aspect was, of course, German anti-Semitism leading to the Holocaust. By the way, is that a known word to everybody? Holocaust with a capital H.
Yes.
Okay. How do you all know it? From what? From what context? How do you know the word? And how do you know the event? Okay. Those of you who went through World War II learned something of it. High school is very recent. We're talking about people in the last 10 years. Some reading. What else? Television. What in television? The Great Series probably made a greater impact than all the previous discussion of anything. So there's that. It's okay. How many of you are familiar with what sometimes are called the other 3 million of the Holocaust? A few. Anybody? What do I mean by that?
Jews, no, the Polish people, the homosexuals,
gypsies. Who else?
Trade unionists.
Trade unionists.
Retarded.
Retarded.
Physically handicapped.
Physically handicapped.
I have to think of the PLO and the Arab group that displaced.
Well, then also in terms of the Holocaust, you have to think about a good number of Lutherans. Matter of fact, one person I wish we had thought of on St. Francis Day was the one of the modern Franciscan saints. And I've been trying to remember his name. Do you remember, Darren? The one who volunteered to die? Oh, yeah. There were after...
Polish.
Yeah, he was a Polish Franciscan.
His first name was
Yeah. He was... there had been an escape out of a prison camp. He had been arrested for being too religious. And since there was an escape, a guard came through and chose 10 men at random to be shot, and one of them was a father who was due to be released and with children, and the Franciscan immediately volunteered to take his place, you know, was taken out and shot. Just one of the modern. And there are people like that, or from our own Lutheran tradition, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So when we speak of the Holocaust, we're speaking of all the people, but specifically in our concern today, we're talking about the 6 million people who were killed as Jews, not because they were Marxist in philosophy, not because they were trade unionist by activity, but simply because they were Jewish, those 6 million, which made an impact on the world that we're just beginning to deal with. Leading to the third aspect of the 20th century, which is the rising theological dialogue of Jews and Christians, really dating back about the last 15 years, say to the late 50s, early 60s, when Christian theologians, initially German, began to reflect on what the event of the Holocaust meant, first of all to Jews, then to Christians, and then to the relationship of Jews and Christians, leading up to some excellent studies in terms of how do we understand Jews and Christians today when there are a great number of Jews who blame Christians for the Holocaust, and a good number of Christians who, looking back, realize the immensity of that action, which somehow happened in a nation that had had Christians in it for the last 1,000 years. How could it happen? A question equally done on both sides. So we have those three things coming down to us: the tradition of the Jewish no to Jesus, the Jewish uniqueness, and the 20th century with Zionism, with the Holocaust, and then the theological dialogue of Jews and Christians today. And I think that's led us now into three areas that we try to separate, but which a great number of Jews in the world refuse to separate. And that is a political, a theological, and a personal approach. We tend to think of those as separate items. That one can carry on a theological dialogue with Judaism without taking a political stance toward Israel. Israeli Jews will not accept this. In fact, if you listen very closely to Menachem Begin as Prime Minister, how many of you remember the peace treaty ceremony in 1979? Remember, and Sadat and Carter and Begin all gave speeches.
if you listen to it closely, Begin followed his normal practice that he did not refer to the state of Israel. He never has in public. The term Medina Yisrael, the state of Israel, for him is an irrelevant term. What's important to him is Ha'am v'Ha'aretz Yisrael, the land and the people of Israel. The state is simply the current manifestation of the land, of the people of Israel on the land of Israel. So the state of Israel could just as easily become the kingdom of Israel, or the republic of Israel, or the whatever of Israel. That can change. The enduring factor is the presence of the people of Israel on the land, in and on the land of Israel. That, and for him, that means Jewish people. Which means that for many people like Begin, you cannot talk about connections with Judaism apart from connection with Israel. They simply are inseparable from the Jewish standpoint. From our American and our Christian standpoint, we divide them. So I can talk about a political opposition to the current Lebanon invasion, without saying somehow that colors my understanding of the relationship of Christians and Jews. But there we need to understand that we're making the division that many Jews will not separate. And third, how do we approach then Jews as individuals when there are perhaps differing theological understandings, different political understandings, and when we have this heritage of not quite sure how Christians deal with Jews? Let me give one example that you brought up. The question of presenting the gospel to the Jewish people. Quick show of hands. How many of you would agree that the gospel should be presented to the Jewish people? Okay. How many would disagree that it ought not to be presented? How many of you aren't sure?
Well, I don't understand who it should be presented. I mean, should we go out there and find Jewish people and present them, or should they have it available to have it be presented to them? I'm not sure.
Okay, it's purposely vague, because I've had it explained that both answers, yes and no, are anti-Semitic.
Sure.
Because there are those who say that a Christian who tries to present the gospel to a Jew and therefore has somehow in the mind an ultimate goal of conversion is trying to make the Jew a Christian, and that's anti-Semitic. However, I've also had Jews who have come to faith in Jesus who say that if our faith is the richest treasure that we have, and we say, I will not share my riches with this other person, but I will share it with a Buddhist and a Muslim and a Hindu and a secular and a neo-pagan and everybody else, I'll share it with everybody except the Jew in the corner, then I'm being anti-Semitic because I am labeling that person and refusing to share my riches of faith with that person. It's a dilemma. How many of you feel somewhat confused about the relationship of Christians and Jews? Yeah.
I think they should be able to if they want to seek the gospel, they should. And if they don't want to, they shouldn't. I don't think it should be forced on them. I mean, if, you know, it's available, like through your church, it is available. And if a Jewish person comes to you and wants to be converted or wants to learn more about it, that's fine. But if they don't, I don't think they should be forced into the situation that they have.
Okay.
That's my opinion.
Okay. Yeah.
During most of the year, I feel like there is nothing in the New Testament that's not in the Old Testament, as far as suffering servanthood and being a people of God. But when I do Passover, I feel horribly sad at the end of it, because the Messiah has come. And that's the horn of the dilemma that I feel myself on.
Okay. Any other reaction?
Yeah, I feel a great deal of confusion in the fact that if you start discussing Christianity and with a Jewish person, and they know that you're a Lutheran, they bring up Luther's anti-Semitism, and I don't know what to do with it. And it's the things that I've heard anti-Semitic that Luther or Martin Luther talked about are very difficult to document or find.
Okay, I think that's a whole subject in itself. All I know is that some of the... Matter of fact, Fortress Press has a book coming out in 1983, which is the Luther year, on that specific question.
But how can you know... Yeah, how that's that you would direct me to that then, as a Lutheran, you have some information?
Okay, I don't think that... there are some who have said that basically the Holocaust happened because Martin Luther didn't like Jews. That's what's called the devil theory of history, is that the whole reason things go bad is because one person did a bad thing.
There is Luther has a treatise on Jews,
yeah.
Which is, I mean, you don't need to look very far for anti-Semitism.
See,
he's very clear about it.
I agree that you can find it in Luther easily. I disagree as a historian with what's called the devil theory of history, that one person can somehow change the whole course of history.
Luther was a man in his times, and everyone in that age was anti-Semitic. That was
I think the ultimate question of confusion is when our children come to us and say, well, will Brooke and Jeremy not get to heaven then, Mommy? And should I be telling them about Jesus all the time, or what do we do? That's, to our family, the ultimate confusion. Brooke and Jeremy being our little Jewish friends, obviously, next door.
We're obviously secular, unless they have Jewish names as well.
You don't go to temple all the time. You take
Have you ever found out their Jewish names?
No, I don't know.
Should ask sometime and ask if their parents gave them Jewish names as well. Because many, many religious families will do that, where they have they will give them a Jewish name and a secular name. Because Brooke and Jeremy are obviously not Hebrew names, but you often have that where there are Hebrew names, which become sometimes even more important them as they grow. Sometimes they are given them as they go through bar bat mitzvah too.
So but the question still remains.
Right,
I mean, what in fact do we do?
Hey, Mo, when you respond to that?
My best friend in high school was a Jewish boy, and he and I talked a great deal. He was Orthodox Jew, and we couldn't go on picnics together without his mother packing his little bag and mine. I couldn't serve him any kind of food. And we talked often about this, and we came to the conclusion that we believe in the same God, and we see him in different forms. We believe as Lutherans believe in the Trinity, and those being different, but one. He still has a faith in God, and he has a very strong faith in God, although he doesn't know Jesus, our Messiah, and we worked it out that way.
Would you say the same thing about a Muslim or a Buddhist or a Hindu?
I don't know that. No, I couldn't personally, because I can't see that worshiping a statue is worshiping the same God. But
I've got a little boy that I send money to, through Christian Children's Fund, and his name's Ignato. And he heard through his sister about Christ. And because he was sitting at his window, his parents wouldn't let him go over to his house. And he sent me a letter and he said, I see balloons, people laughing, praying. And he said, I heard something about this Christ. So I sat down and wrote him a letter. And he wrote me back. And he says, I was very much happy to hear about this Jesus. And I was very pleased that I had the opportunity to introduce him. So, there's no statues involved in that. He's a Muslim.
I'd seen a hand over here sometime.
Going back to the idea of presenting the gospel to Jews, to a Jewish wedding in Miami in May, some really wonderful people, talking to a fellow who is an Orthodox Jew, that's not the right term. A religious Jew. I'll put it down. So I don't know. And course of conversation, we were talking. He said, my Christianity and him being a Jew. He's just, his point was, or his comment was just, well, we believe the Messiah is still to come. And other people, other Jews have said to me, well, you know, the Messiah, we still believe is to come, indicating to me that they obviously know Jesus and know what I believe in that, and I think this whole tradition has been learned. And there, you know, it's not a case of taking the gospel to a people who does not understand or have that tradition of learning about the New Testament. I think that that is part of that heritage. And so it's not a case of either taking or not taking the gospel. They know about it.
I think that this is true of religious Jews, but not of secular Jews, and certainly not of anti-religious Israeli Jews. I have found that talking, not, I don't know about this expression, present the gospel, it sounds like a serving trade, but talking about my faith with Israeli Jews and American Jews has been the most exciting conversation about my what I believe in and what they mostly don't believe anything that I've ever experienced. And it is a great challenge. It's really kind of fun because you have to start at, it's not like picking up with another Christian where you've already got all the context. You all know about Jesus, you know about grace, and that's all. Just, you can go off to other things. You have to really start at base zero. And when I was in Israel particularly, people would ask me about my behaviors because they interpreted religious as being entirely law-dominated. Because in Israel, religious Jews are the law. And how can you dance and still call yourself religious? There's about lots of good opportunities to talk about grace and what Jesus means and what he asks of us too. That was really thrilling. So I love to talk about my faith with Jewish people, selfishly. That's presenting my faith, I think, in a sense.
We take our confirmation classes to the seminary camps in Albuquerque. Once one of the kids asked the rabbi, what is the difference between Judaism and Christianity? I was, of course, interested in his answer. His answer was, Christianity teaches people how to go to heaven when they die. Judaism teaches people how to live together on this earth. And evidently we had taught him that was the main purpose of what our whole faith is all about. And the fact that we ask that question so much, that our children ask that question, and the first thing on our minds and the first thing on our children's minds, just proves that what he says is probably accurate. Mm-hmm. And my personal opinion, we should stop right even asking that question. So maybe it's not what it's all about.
Yeah, I think one of the exciting aspects of conversations, either congregational contact with a synagogue nearby of a dialogue nature, or family contact with neighbors, or individual contact with people, is that sense of being able to ask a question about religion with someone who is very, not very close to us in faith, but someone who has seen Christianity from the beginning. In other words, if you go to a Buddhist tradition or the Hindu tradition, you're sometimes dealing with a different historical background to it all. But when you speak about Judaism, you can talk about a shared historic tradition and a sharing in history since the time of Jesus. And I think it's exactly that kind of thing. They are people who have experienced the kind of teaching that we present. We don't see the significance of a lot of our questions until someone says, why do you always ask that kind of question? Or when someone puts it back and we say, well, no, that's not really what we teach. But then they say, but that's all we ever hear. And I think that's where it becomes very exciting to us and very challenging to us. And I think in many ways, as we talked in our Roman study, where Judaism is something of a continuing judgment upon the church.
reminding us of the way we are and the way we teach in the world around us today. I think there is an element of confusion. And I'd like to have one more question come up in terms of a political level, and that is the question of our understanding as Christians toward the modern state of Israel. Especially as Israel, as it's interpreted by Jews, as an expression of continued Jewish aspiration, as an expression of Jewish hope, and as the establishment of a Jewish homeland in the world. How do we, as Christians, relate to it then? Ought we to be supportive, neutral, deal with it as simply a member of the family of nations? How do we relate to this political Judaism that has developed in the 20th century, which has not been true, need to remember, since 70 AD, except the community level and ghetto operations and the rabbinic style within a synagogue, since between 70 and 1948, there simply was no Jewish state.
Very supportive. We've been very supportive.
Okay, we have been.
Yes.
Okay, how is that an expression of Christian concern? You had your hand.
Well, I was going to say that I find it hard and difficult because I think you can understand the desire, for the state. On the other hand, thinking of all people, you can't help but think of Palestinians and the other part that's involved. So that if you're trying to have some kind of a Christian feeling, it's hard just to zero in on one aspect of it and toss out the other. And so it's kind of it's just a little difficult.
Okay, yeah.
Well, you mentioned political Israel, and you also said political Judaism. How does this two relate?
Okay, I'm thinking about Israel simply as a real fact.
Yeah.
By the way, I think that question about the accepting the existence of the modern state of Israel it's an irrelevant question. I mean, it exists. And, you know, I was going to look that up in my old Latin one. It is, therefore it is. You know, I think, therefore I am. It's there, and the question of its existence or non-existence is simply irrelevant.
No, but the expansion of it.
Okay, but I think so. Political Israel is simply that there is a state in the world called Israel, and it is a very political animal in the world, as is Egypt, as is Tanzania, as is the United States. They're all political animals in the political world. So, political Israel, that is, that there exists an Israel which can, and political Judaism, that is, that the concerns for the action of the modern state of Israel are not limited to its citizens, but that the vast majority of Jews in the world have taken certain political stances with respect to that as an expression of their own faith. That is, that, or as an expression of their life as Jews. So being a Jew means that the majority of them take a political stance toward Israel. It's hard to find a similar sense in which we as Christians are automatically driven toward taking any political stance. We might do it on the basis of wisdom and understanding, knowledge and experience and the rest, but there are very few political issues that Christians, as Christians, automatically concern themselves with. And I think the vast majority of Christians is. So political Judaism is simply that Jews in the world take political concern toward Israel, regardless of their religious or non-religious feelings.
Does that come under your original heading of the Jewish uniqueness that you were talking about, being able to say...
Yeah.
We were differentiating between
them. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
When Christians more or less think of Israel, I think they think of it in the sense of revelation, in the this is what was to come. Anytime I hear a Christian talk about Israel, they always bring up the word revelation in it, as this is, you know, the ending times or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
I find it very difficult to separate Israel, to put Israel in with a lot of other nations. I want, because this is my personal I don't know what it is, emotional commitment to the Jews, the post-Holocaust group, the country, or what, but I somehow demand more of them ethically. I want Israel somehow to be more righteous than anybody else and not behave this way. So, you know, it's a source of great frustration for me, because I want to love them more, or I'm trying to compensate somehow for guilt, or I'm not sure what it is, but I demand more righteousness from Israeli Jews and from the state of Israel than I do of Afghanistan or these other countries where equally horrendous things are probably happening.
Which raised an issue as the about the third week in June, as the bombing of Lebanon, or as the bombing of Beirut really began, and there was the initial outcry, first from Europe and then very belatedly from the United States. And there was strong criticism. Prime Minister Begin came out with one statement in which, a reporter asked him, said, Mr. Prime Minister, there is this very harsh criticism coming that what Israel, the IDF, is doing is wrong and simply immoral. And his response is, don't preach to us that the Western European nations and the Christian world have no right to preach ethics and morality to us. Response, what do you think?
Well, I think maybe we may have the emotional feeling of demanding more from Israel, but also as a nation to let them behave in extra kinds of ways that we would never let others behave.
You know, which is really interesting that we hold both things at the same time.
You know, I've heard people say that maybe the fortunate thing about what's going on now is that we will now begin to expect of Israel the norm in terms of action of all nations, and they'll say that's not going to be allowed.
Okay. When I look at this conflict that's going on now, when I look at the PLO, I say, and when Israel went in and everybody started criticizing it for it, I said, well, how long, you know, it's like a little kid kicking a big kid in the shins, and just how long is this big kid going to take it? And I think it was just the point that Israel said that's enough, and we're going in. I'm not promoting what Israel has done there, but it's something that maybe they felt it had to be done.
Mm-hmm. We're almost at 11:45, and I know some of you want to get, one last thing.
I'm not so sure I'm right on what we're talking about in a sense, but I think it shows the Israeli conflict. It shows the inability of we Christians to put the same weight on the same types of events that are going on around the world. There's some 19 wars going on around the world right now, conflicts, armed conflicts. And that's the only one we really concentrate on. We really aren't condemning or doing anybody, the rest of them. They don't concern us. They're not Israels, they're not Jews, they're people we don't understand. They're black, they're yellow, they're Spanish speaking, they're this, they're that, they're all. But they're not the Jews, we just concentrate. I feel like somehow we are this conflict and everything. We have this unevenness.
We're going to talk some more about that tomorrow night when we get into a background in the Middle East conflict. I think it is 11:45, and some of you want to get to first lunch, and some of us have to do dish team. I'd like to end with just a couple of things. One is partly I wanted to experiment with something today. And I think one of the thoughts I had down on my paper was that it looked like it was going to be confusing, and I think it is. I think most of us feel a little confused by this whole question of relationship of Christians and Jews on theological levels, on biblical levels, on political levels, on questions like, ought I to tell Jeremy and Brooke about Jesus? Or what do I tell my kids about Jews, especially like at Christmas Hanukkah or at Easter Passover or the High Holy Days that come up in late September and October. I think the first step I think we all need to take individually and I think very much within our congregations is to begin to get to know the Judaism that does exist. Just by talking to people and finding out and developing some programs within our congregations of relationships with the temples and synagogues that are in the area.
just to find out the information that we don't have. I think that's a step. Secondly, as was pointed out by Dan and Anne and others, that it is a fantastic way of doing some real study of our faith. For example, Hermeneia, the new biblical series that Fortress Press is bringing out, has, I think, about six of the studies in the Old Testament series being written by Jewish professors at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And I've been trying to find another Christian commentary series in the past that ever used Jewish scholars to write on the Hebrew books. The fascinating thing that could be done by asking a rabbi from your community to come in and lead a six-week series on Isaiah. Even more exciting to ask a rabbi from the community to come in and lead a six-week series on Paul's letter to the Romans. What it can mean for our own learning and our own understanding of the riches of our heritage, I think, is another step. So, and I think the third thing is for us to deal within ourselves and within our congregation with some of those serious mission concerns. You know, how do we see ourselves currently in the modern world in terms of sharing the gospel, and very particularly with Jewish people, in terms of what has happened in the 20th century? Which means, first of all, eliminating all of those pictures that we basically have from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which are irrelevant portraits of Jews for today. And you cannot talk about modern Jews as being like the Pharisees any more than you can talk about the modern church being like the early church in Jerusalem. We've got 2,000 years in between. So I think some personal learning and some support for some corporate learning and sharing on behalf of our congregations. And third, just some continued reflection in our own minds. How do I look on these issues, particularly, say, the issues of Israel, modern Israel, particularly the issue of what could be called the mission of the Jews, as a Christian, not as a Westerner, not as a citizen of the United States or of Canada, not as one who recognizes that there's a lot of oil concern, but how do I, as a Christian in the post-Holocaust world, deal with these political issues? I don't have any answers to that. I feel a great degree of confusion myself, but like Anne said, it's exciting to think about.